This is Ruth Blue interviewing Liz Lash on the 19th of October 2012 at her home in Polegate for Thalidomide, an oral history project. Liz, could you confirm that you've seen and signed the copyright and consent forms?
Yes, I have.
And would you mind starting just by telling me your full name, age, date and place of birth?
Elizabeth Audrey Lash, and I'm 52 years old. My date of birth is the 11th of the 5th, 1960, and I was born in Eastbourne, East Sussex.
Thank you. The first part of the interview is mostly about your childhood, your birth, your family and school life, and any early medical interventions you might have had. So first of all, if we could talk a little bit about your family background.
Sure.
Who are your parents? What line of work were they in? And do you have any siblings?
I have no siblings for almost a biological reason, in that sadly, my parents were only actually married for 4 years. They married in 1956. They met at Kingsmead Preparatory School in Seaford, where they were at the time were both teachers. My father previously had been a Major General in the Arab Legion, serving under Ghulam Pasha. The only reason I mention that is because the family background he came from had added to the pressures that my mother was later to be under. My mother was teaching there, although her heart was very much in the state system, but she needed to get out of another job because she didn't like the head. And the system was very different in those days. As I say, they married in 1956. My mother was then 32, and they had a very different view on having babies at later ages in those days, and so she didn't think she would have children. My father also was 16 years older than she was, so therefore the thought was there probably wouldn't be any children. But lo and behold, she became pregnant in 1959, and I rolled along in May of 1960. Now, unfortunately, 3 months previous to that, when she was 6 months pregnant, my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He had cancer of the throat and esophagus. The feeling probably was, talking to my mother later, because she was quite happy to talk about it. I mean, not happy, but okay, that sounds awful.
Open,
that's a better word, yeah. That he probably had known that it was around for quite some time before. To describe, the best way I can do is to tell you what happened is to say what she said to me, which is the surgeons opened him up to see what they could do, and found that he was riddled with secondaries. I'm using the word secondaries, that isn't the word that was used then, but I'm using the more up-to-date language, and they closed him up. It was obviously a sad and fraught and difficult time. My mother, I will need to talk about her parents later and her relationships with her siblings, but at the moment, she was very isolated. My father's family, their two families didn't gel, because the only word I can use is almost, we're verging on the upper class with my father's family. And my mother's family, lower middle, if you like. And so it was quite a big divide, and that made life even more difficult. My mother was prescribed thalidomide, Distival, to give it its pharmaceutical name at the time, for and not for morning sickness like the majority, but for insomnia. Now, she was, I don't think this is a great surprise, she was suffering from insomnia at the time, when you think what she was going through. I think, when I think of the time pattern, that it was probably because it was, as when I look back, that it was about the time my father was probably first becoming ill, and she knew she was pregnant at the same time. There were also issues with her own family, and so it was a very complex time. I was born in the May, and I was left for the first month of my life. We lived in the cottage on the estate of the prep school, which had used to be the bicycle shed it was built on. So my father said that his child spent a first month in the bicycle shed. Subsequently, it became clear that my father was, I did use the word terminal, and it wasn't working for my mother living there with him and with me, set aside the fact that I was severely disabled anyway, and so there were, the complexities of that, and who knew what was going to happen. And so they moved in with my father's sister, who had a large house in Lushington Road in Eastbourne, and that was where my father lived. And my mother stayed with me, I think, but I'm not entirely sure whether she stayed with him or lived with her parents in Seaford. I never asked the question, I'm not quite sure what happened. Life being more complicated, my maternal grandparents had actually been in Canada at the time of my birth. Their belongings, they were travelling, their belongings were all in storage, and there was a massive fire on the morning of my birth, and their belongings all went up in smoke, so it was just an unbelievable series of chain of events. My father eventually died in the August. Now there's a gap here. I do not know exactly where I was living between the August and the December, where my mother was with me. I'm not sure. It wasn't a question I ever asked. But I do know that in the December of my first year of life, December 1960, my mother moved with her parents to a bungalow in West Ham, which was a three-bedroomed bungalow, two reception rooms. I'm telling you that for a reason, to make you smile in a minute, I can assure you. A largest piece of land and a garage, for the princely sum of £3,000.
Okay, it's just impossible to imagine. Isn't it?
It's initially they needed a mortgage, which is even funnier, I always think. I love that bit of the story.
Yeah.
So then that's when they actually moved in, because that's the sort of thing my grandparents did. They were quite mad, the parents, on Christmas Eve. They would do that. So there we were, mother widowed, with severely disabled child and parents.
Okay, I'm going to take you back a little bit as well, but that's a very dramatic.
It's not bad. It's a start. I said I came in with a big bang, but
I was going to ask you, do you know how long your mum took the lidomide for?
A relatively short period of time, as far as we can make out. Now, this is where I need to jump forward, yeah. I'm afraid.
Okay.
I only discovered in 2009 that she took it.
Yes.
She was very, very ill at the time. I only had a small opportunity to ask her questions.
Mm-hmm.
And what I needed to ask her at the time were practical, pertinent questions, because it was distressing enough for her to be asked. Mm. It was a very, very difficult situation, very awkward. I had to go back and look through her medical notes to find it, because we needed the evidence for the thalidomide trust.
Yes.
Or I needed the evidence, I should say. I was thinking of David myself, because he was being so supportive at the time. It was certainly recorded that she was prescribed it, and she certainly knew she'd taken it. Her sister also confirmed to me before we'd had that conversation that she'd been prescribed it. She had always known that I was thalidomide and been told not to tell me. Families, it's a very complex one, this one.
That is very complex. Not heard that before.
That's very odd. Both her younger sister, who's 13 years her junior, my aunt, to whom I'm very close and who knows all about this, she lives in Canada, but I've been in contact with her about this, and it's fine to mention her name and anything else. I've sort of had it because I thought I ought to check with her. And also my mother's older brother, who died a few years ago, he also knew And I have discovered that when he came over here, when he knew he was terminally ill, essentially to say goodbye, his real reason was to say to my mother, have you not told Liz yet? You really ought to tell her she's the lidomide, how much she's missing out. And that's what he actually came here to do. And I didn't, I mean, I had no reason, I know, no, you know.
So for instance, one
it's of very, my... very odd one.
One of my questions is, you know, were you ever able to discuss with your parents their decision to use thalidomide?
Well, right.
But you did it on...
Yeah, I mean, it was a very strange one. I mean, my mother took it for... I mean, she went... this is where we had to start tracking it, because it was like... I mean, it's fortunate that I understand a lot about medical, my own interest. I'm reasonably au fait with medical language and things. But I actually had to go back through all her medical notes. Surgery were absolutely fantastic. Fortunately, they found all the previous notes. They were brilliant. I mean, dreadfully difficult situation for the GP, because the GP was the same for myself and my mother. And so he was, awful for him, because he's known all these years, and of course he couldn't tell me.
And he was the person who prescribed it for your mother?
No, he wasn't. The prescription. Now, he was actually prescribed by a doctor at a hospital in Brighton. She was living in New Haven at the time, before she got married. And she was when she got married, moved to Seaford. She stayed with this Kitty Kendrew, that was her name, Kendrew. And she had sent my mother to Brighton Hospital. I am not quite sure why. That's not sort of, and it was the doctor there who prescribed the Distobal, because it's a different doctor's writing. That's why we knew it was. And it's only mentioned once, and then a bit later on, it's got something about review, and that's all it says. So we assume that she was on it as far as she could remember, because I did ask. She said, I certainly took it for, it must have been about a month. Well, that's, if it's the right trimester, if it crosses that trimester, there we are, and it was certainly good enough for the Lidomide Trust. So she certainly knew. That it had done the damage. There isn't. I mean, once I had faced her with it, she didn't deny it, although she denied it to me for 50 years.
So, had you asked her before? Had you suspected and asked her at other points in your life?
No, never. No. Because I had always believed what she told me, and she'd always told me I wasn't thalidomide. She even went to the point of saying that she had talked to the then GP, which is another one, what else it could have been. Whether she was trying to justify it to herself, I have no idea. But I wasn't able to follow up that bit. It wasn't important at the time. I had to pick what was important. Because, we had like a 2-hour conversation with her about it. And then I went with the notes and sorted all that out. I mean, that was, I'm jumping forward to, my investigation started in February 2009, and I was subsequently accepted in the trust in the December. But there was an awful lot of work during that time, and I had the conversation with her in the August.
And did she explain to you why she hadn't told you?
That's a really difficult one. I mentioned family pressure. Now, this was huge. Her mother, I was so careful how I put this, was not a very pleasant person. She was also, sadly, I think, somebody who had mental health problems that, as was being the case in those days, was not diagnosed. Seriously, I mean, I would say verging on paranoia. That's not a joke. You know, I'm absolutely serious using that word. I would use it in its medical sense. And she was... put incredible amounts of pressure on my mother when everything started to bubble mid to late 60s and early 70s. She put a tremendous amount of pressure on my mother. Don't get involved, the papers will get involved, people will know, which was always her bug, her thing. She ruled my mother. By this time, her younger sister, to whom my mother was very close, my mother pretty much brought up her 13-year-old younger sister, because my grandmother didn't want another baby. I mean, this tells you what a strange person. She told her own daughter how much she tried to abort her. I mean, how she tried to get rid of her. I mean, I don't know how anyone gets off of that. I mean, I didn't get on with my grandmother. I didn't like her. From a young age, living in the same house, I saw how she treated my mother and how she made my mother feel and how I made my mother, and I couldn't deal with it. And I'm too direct and I'm very different and I couldn't deal with it, and I was so unkind. That pressure was coming from that side. At the same time, from her and her sister, by this time, was living in Canada. Both her siblings were now living in Canada. And the basic reason in both cases was to get away from mother. That's the basic reason they'd gone. Her older brother had epilepsy, and basically it was made to feel ashamed of it by his mother, and also by his father to a lesser extent, although my grandfather wasn't. I think that was pressure. And couldn't cope. He was more like his mother, but he couldn't cope. And he went just in the early 50s, he went to Canada, not long after the end of the war, really. And meanwhile, my mother's younger sister, Diana, married and an architect who got a job in Canada, and they emigrated in 63. So my mother now has got the pressure of her mother. My grandfather, who is a very different person, sadly, lovely man, he died in 1967, just before it all started. So he was out of the picture. So it's my mother and her mother. My father's family, now there was certainly two members of his family, I think, looking back, probably were viewing this slightly differently. But I don't know. They are not still alive. I can't ask them questions. Because my mother was 36 when she gave birth to me, because my father was 16 years older than she was, all that side of the family were a lot older than they should have been, is how I'd put it. So my aunts and my uncle, particularly my uncle, who I was very close to, my father's brother, who was a Franciscan friar. He was a bishop for a time in his life. And I was very close to Bill. I think that he was probably possibly the one who might have tried. And also my father's sister, who was a nurse up at St. Thomas's, she might have tried. But it's an interesting fact that although there were other members of the family, I got left money by both of them when they died. And it's almost as if there was, because my father didn't have any money to leave when he died, I forgot that bit. Not they were trying to make up for it, I don't mean that, but there was a definite sort of, and I think that's quite interesting. So with the pressure there was on her, and then I think as the years went on, she just pushed it away.
I think it gets harder sometimes to go back on something once you've started, doesn't it? And then it means you've got to admit you've lied. And nobody wants to do that.
No. And also, in her eyes, I was making a success of my life. She didn't see or understand, and right up to the end, to her, the disability world was a frightening one that she didn't want me part of. Sadly, she couldn't see that actually there is a positive side to it too, and that you can, for want of a better word, straddle, which is what I've learnt to do. But I came to that very late because I was kept away. I mean, some of what she did was absolutely right. When it comes to education, what she did was absolutely right. Mm. And I've got no, because she would not have me go to, in inverted commas, a special school. She was going to have me educated mainstream.
I'm going to go on to that.
I know, but that's,
Birth.
Any more about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The birth. I'd like to know about your birth, how the birth went, and what happened immediately after your birth. Do you know was your mum sedated?
Know very little, I'm afraid. Okay. I'm really sorry. All I can tell you is that they took me away. And I think they did that with most disabled children, that mind you, I think they still do it sometimes. And it was a case of, I know there's something wrong with the baby. Now, she gave birth not in hospital, but in a maternity home, a word you don't hear anymore, Upperton Road maternity home in Eastbourne. And she was being looked after by a doctor who was a close friend of my father's and whose name has just jumped out of my head, which is awful because he was a lovely man and he went on to found our hospice, St Wilfrid's Hospice. Kent, Basil Kent, sorry. A brain cell went, I think, just died for a moment there.
We did a lot of remembering. So.
And I don't think about these things very often. And he was the one who came and said to my mother, your child is very, you have a baby, is very, very pretty disabled. I added to the confusion by, if you like, they thought initially I'd got hydrocephalus and then decided I'd just got a, excuse me, you're allowed to laugh, a very big head. Some things don't change. And I had terrible trouble feeding right from the word go because I'd got pyloric stenosis, although that wasn't diagnosed until about a few weeks later because it's not diagnosed initially. So there was a lot of kerfuffle going on. I know very little about what actually happened straight afterwards because the problem was there was my, my father very, he was coming, being brought in, he was ill. Basil Kent was a friend. So it was all a bit cliquey is the only word that springs to mind.
Yes.
So I really can't answer much of that because I don't know.
So your parents never spoke about how they felt when they first realised you'd been born with
Right. My mother said, I can tell you that. And I also will tell you that my grandmother did one of the few really good things that I do know about. My mother said somebody said to her, will you keep her? Now, I'm not entirely sure who said that, but I think from what she said, unfortunately, sad though it is, it was a nurse in the nursing home. Sounds par for the course in those days, I'm afraid. And my mother said, good gracious me, what do you mean keep her? She said, I was absolutely furious. She said, because, you weren't a stray dog, you were my daughter. You were Liz. Because I'd already decided I was going to, even though Liz was what I was going to be called. And her view was that what mattered was that I was going to be what was left of Noel. Sorry, that was what my father was called. I haven't said that. His name was Norman Oliver Lash, but he was Noel. Quirky things they do with names and sometimes. And that was always the thought. Because if I'd been a boy, I was going to be Nicholas Oliver Lash, which was another family name, so that then I could have been Noel myself if I'd wanted to later in life. But so I think that the feeling was she certainly never wavered from, I was never going to be one of the ones that was put away, which was something else that was said to her. My grandmother, I have always said, and my mother doesn't think I'm wrong on this because we did talk about it, didn't think I was wrong on this, that it may be my grandfather's idea. And bear in mind that people stayed in longer when they had babies in those days. The second day she was in the nursing home after I was born, my grandmother sent me flowers, which for her was quite a remarkable thing to do. And to my mother, it was like somebody acknowledging that I existed. But she was always determined. The only slight problem that this then developed into was an obsession with me, which was a bit unfortunate. Because her life then became me.
Oh, an obsession with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
And I think...
Yes.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I can see that looking back. Mm. And that's not something I think that's important to record because I think it was to do with her own mental health issues. And I think also it gave her something positive to focus on, which I totally understand with her husband dying and knowing that she was going to be living with her parents. And her sister, whom she adored, was the other side of the Atlantic. And you've got a child who is going to need a lot more support.
Can you describe your level of impairment for the sake of...
I thought you might want to. When I was born, that's slightly different to what it was subsequently. When I was born, both legs very short and bent upwards. I mean, my mother told me that she couldn't keep my feet out of my nappies.
Oh, bent up.
Yes, yeah, that's right, bent yes. round in yes. upwards. My left arm, I have no thumb on the left side at all. The wrist was very bent. My left arm was actually bent up towards my shoulder. The shoulder is very malformed, although in fact it's typical, but we didn't, I wasn't aware of this at the time. And my shoulder blades are also typical of thalidomide. My right shoulder, its problems really have come through overuse. It's not too bad. The arm is a little short, but not short like the left arm. My right wrist doesn't bend properly. I don't have a thumb, but there was a residual flap of skin that had to be removed. That was actually on my finger, not on my thumb. I'm fortunate in that my ears are not affected. Internally, that was not to show until later. But there is damage internally, but that wasn't at the time that nobody knew that was there. I mean, yes, I had pyloric stenosis, the muscle thing, which was put right by surgery when I was about 8 weeks old. And that it was that causing trouble when I was in 2009 that caused me to start looking. So.
So would that operation for the pyloric stenosis, would that have been your first medical intervention?
Yes, it was.
And do you know how long you were in hospital for that?
I have no idea. But I mean, I was a tiny baby. I wouldn't like to say. Mm. I don't know. A few days, I would think.
Mm. And did you have any other medical interventions?
The first, early on? Right, not in the first few months of life. The first things would have been when I was about 18 months old, when they started via manipulation to bring down my left arm. And I was in a heavy cast, which on more than one occasion I nearly knocked my poor mother out with it. That was actually quite successful. And that was done locally, because that's the important thing. This was done at no longer around St Mary's Hospital in Eastbourne. Mm. I don't know who did it. I haven't any idea. They started to look at my legs, and I think they decided that their skill was not, they couldn't do it. And I was referred when I was two to Queen Mary's Hospital at Roehampton.
Yeah,
which I'm sure you've heard. Yes,
know it well.
Yes, but you might have done.
Yes,
because it's either going to be Carshorton or Roehampton, depending from this area, isn't it? Well, I was a Roehampton one, yeah. And I was put under the care of another name that you will know, Leon Gillis. Mm. And he struck up a very good rapport with my mother. And again, jumping forward slightly, I mean, I know he died in 67, but the last time he met with my mother and with me, he actually said to her, things are going to happen about, she told me this about thalidomide, you need to make sure that Liz has what she's entitled to. It's not your fault. And I find that she actually told me that off her own.
I was going to say, given that you were going to Roehampton,
I thought it was quite interesting.
And they had such a collection of thalidomide children.
I mean, I know. I mean, when I was in contact with Martin Johnson at Thalidomide Trust, I mean, I asked him about several of the children. I said, what happened to, do you know? And of course, the trouble is, because I was a child, I couldn't remember many, it was a surname. Some surnames came back to me, one in particular, a child that my mother had, struck up a very good rapport with, and he was able to tell me something quite interesting, which I could then, because I said, can you tell me quickly, because my mother's very, and I was like, and that was quite, and she was actually quite, because they were, it wasn't that they thalidomide, that wasn't why she was interested in them as people, and she was very pleased to know that this